Well, good morning. It's really a privilege to be here. Morning. Yeah, as Troy said, I've sojourned among the Presbyterians for a lot of years, and really am grateful for the fantastic students I've had at Princeton and the many people I've gotten to know through them. And he's right, I begged for a chance to come out and speak to you and be with you. It's a privilege to partner with you in educating future clergy and servants of God in many different spheres of life. I have a little bit of pastoral experience before I went to graduate school, but for the most part, I'm in the classroom, and it's really vital for what I do to stay connected with all of you. And so I look forward to hearing from you this week, just about what God's doing in your lives, in your churches, what your hopes, what your dreams, your vision for the future is. That will make me a more effective teacher. It will also just build me up and strengthen me in faith. So I look forward to, as Paul says, sharing spiritual gifts one with another, that God might build us all up. So as Troy said, I'm now in Durham, North Carolina. We moved last summer, and I'm in the midst still of getting used to Southern speak again. There's some really great expressions like might, could, that may come out, but I'm not fully acculturated yet. I've still got some of this New Jersey stuff rolling around my head. I was asked last night, why 1 Peter? And so you've heard part of the story now. Apparently, y'all don't want to hear about Jesus. Actually, Peter's going to tell us a lot about Jesus. When I thought about what I could bring to you all in the short compass, one of the reasons to choose 1 Peter is it's short. And I encourage you to read it daily. Just make it part of it. It takes 10 minutes, 15 minutes, but we can get a sense of the whole of this letter very quickly. Another reason, though, is reflected in the title for this series of lessons, and that is Hopeful Witness in a Post-Christian World. 1 Peter is unique among the New Testament documents in being addressed to a wide swath of churches throughout a really huge geographical area. Peter addresses this to churches spread through an area that would be roughly the size of New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, to speak in terms that I grew up with. And he's speaking to churches that are very much on the margins of their societies. And I think about the church in the West, particularly in North America, in many places, perhaps more on the East Coast even than on the West Coast, living at the margins of the culture. There are certainly important differences in that our culture continues to have Christian influence in all kinds of ways. People in some ways are inoculated to the radical nature of the claims that Christians make about human beings, about God, about the world. But the church is increasingly marginal to society. And 1 Peter presents a vision of a church that understands itself to be marginal and yet remains engaged in patient, humble, loving witness to neighbors who often react with suspicion and hostility. Of the New Testament documents, 1 Peter speaks the most and the most extensively about suffering, suffering for the sake of identifying with Jesus Christ. And I think it's that conjunction between suffering and yet continued witness in hope that makes 1 Peter so powerful for us today. Ben alluded last night to 2 Timothy 3, which promises us that all Scripture is God-breathed and that it is therefore useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, training in righteousness, that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. And that's my hope as we open up 1 Peter together, is that the Spirit will work, that we will be equipped for our continuing witness from the margins in a world that so desperately needs to know the good news about what God has done in Jesus Christ and what God continues to do through this risen Lord and Savior. New Testament scholars sometimes speak about reading the New Testament as if we were reading someone else's mail. I don't know if you've heard that used. Actually, my doctor father has used that. I don't like that way of thinking. I think it actually reveals a theological error. And I say that with humility, drawing on Robert Jensen, who points out that we confess that there is one holy Catholic and apostolic church, which means that the communities addressed in 1 Peter are the same community to which we now belong. This is not someone else's mail. These letters are addressed to the church of which we are a part. Yet at the same time, just changing the metaphor slightly, if 1 Peter belongs to our family story, it belongs to an earlier time in that story. It's a family heirloom, and yet it was written to people who inhabited a vastly different time and space and culture. And so, in fact, although it belongs to us and it is addressed to us, recognizing the historical and cultural difference and distance that separates us from 1 Peter is essential to being able to hear this as a word freshly addressed to us. Just to the extent that we can find something besides our own view of the world, our own already settled opinions in the pages of Scripture, just so does it have the ability to challenge us, to speak a good and fresh word to us, to reshape our view of ourselves and our world. So in this first session, I want to give a little bit of a history lesson. And I do so now without apology, because it's actually essential to the interpretive task that we learn something about the situation to which this letter was first addressed. And our job then will be to seek creatively to draw analogies between this situation and our own. As we read Scripture and find ourselves addressed by it, we can think with this earlier stage in the community's life. And it's great, there's a big clock here with big numbers, so I won't go over, I promise. My goal is actually to talk for about 45 or 50 minutes and then have some questions each time. But I'll just warn you that I got done with a big lecture class this last term in which I had an hour and 15 minutes each time, so there's going to be a little bit of an adjustment. All right, well, 1 Peter, let's look at the first couple verses together. The book includes an outline, and there's place to write notes, and there'll be some text that I refer to. This is a really difficult letter to outline, so this is not by any means the only way you could look at the letter. But everybody agrees the first two verses are a salutation, a greeting. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the exiles of the dispersion, I think that this is the NRSV, really it's to the foreigners, to the resident aliens of the diaspora, in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who have been chosen and destined by God the Father and sanctified by the Spirit to be obedient to Jesus Christ and to be sprinkled with his blood, may grace and peace be yours in abundance. This appears to be a circular letter. That is, a letter addressed to a lot of different communities spread out through a large geographical area. I was going to try to draw Asia Minor up here, but my artistic skills aren't so good. If you can think of modern-day Turkey, Pontus and Bithynia are up on the Black Sea, up north. Cappadocia is as you go west toward Iraq. Galatia is kind of the big middle section of Asia Minor. And Asia is the province centered around Ephesus, on the west coast of Asia Minor, includes many of the islands that have a traditional Greek heritage. And so the letter carrier appears to have started up north, Pontus, and then taken his way around in a counterclockwise arc back up to Bithynia. The area, then, that is embraced by this letter includes a diversity of cultures, places with rich history, places with their own long-standing traditions, going back millennia. But for our purposes, two developments in the political and social history of Asia Minor are particularly important. One is what is called Hellenization. Alexander the Great, at the end of the 4th century, in a lightning conquest, basically took the entire Persian Empire and brought it under his control. And this vast territory was thus ruled by a kind of elite layer of Macedonians and Greeks who stayed in power by, in a sense, preserving all of the local elites just under themselves. And Alexander found cities. He brings institutions of Greek culture into areas as far as modern-day Afghanistan and India. And in Asia Minor, he founds a number of important cities. And after Alexander's death, Asia Minor is one of the areas fought over by his successors. And the territory ends up getting broken up among several of these successors. So in the wake of Alexander, though, you have Greek language and culture as a kind of elite layer that, in a really remarkable cultural fusion, begins to interact with all of these various local traditions to produce a flowering of culture that is probably unprecedented in the ancient world. So the local sense of all of these places is not lost, but there is a common language now and a common cultural orientation. And so Hellenism generally is always a factor in these various areas. We have evidence that well into our era, local places kept their native languages. So Galatia, for example, is named after the Gauls who settled there from what's now France. And Celtic continued to be spoken well into Jerome's time. But Greek is a language that everyone, especially in the urban areas and especially the upper classes, would learn. So there's an ability to communicate now over a vast swath of territory. The second major development is the coming of Rome. Early in the second century, as Rome has now taken care of Carthage, begins to move east to assert its dominance. In 133 BCE, the province of Asia is formed in the Roman Empire as the king of the Attalid kingdom, centered on Pergamum, dies and wills his kingdom to the Romans. And this is sort of the pattern throughout the next century or more, that as local rulers pass away, the Romans come in and take over. A major exception to this is the kingdom of Mithridates, who fights a couple wars with Rome that probably are among the most dangerous wars that Rome ever fought for its own well-being. But Rome ends up eventually master of all of Asia Minor. During the century and a half or so in which it is conquering this territory and assimilating this territory, there's tremendous building of cities, reorganization politically, building of roads to facilitate military movements and then ultimately economic and trade. And so by the time that Peter would be writing in the first century of our era, most of Asia Minor is connected, cities and their territory. It's a highly populated area. Contrary to what you'll read in some of the older commentaries, these are not rural local or yokels that are being addressed. These are probably fairly urbanized people who've now been well integrated into the Roman Empire. One other facet of Romanization that is important is to recognize that this takes place in two very different manners. The first century or so of Roman occupation and rule is one that is marked by conquest and by exploitation. The Romans tax the heck out of Asia Minor to finance their continued imperial expansion. And as civil war develops in the Roman Republic, Asia Minor becomes a source of funds and material for this ongoing war. So Pompey the Great, in his wars with Caesar, bleeds Asia Minor dry. The debt in most of these kingdoms and cities doubles in the years that Pompey is at war with Caesar. Then when Caesar is assassinated, Cassius and Brutus flee east. And Cassius, again, taxes the Romans so much, the Greek cities of Asia Minor, so much so that rulers complained that they were having to take their own jewelry and offer their silverware to the Romans in order to pay the taxes that were demanded. When Antony fights Octavian in yet another civil war, Antony again milks Asia Minor for funds. So this is a disastrous time, this time of the Roman Republic and especially the civil wars, a disastrous time for these places. When Octavian finally defeats Antony, the tide turns, however. Octavian, who later becomes Augustus, takes the side of these cities in his empire, begins to give relief for debts, begins to ameliorate their poor conditions. He sees it as a place that needs to thrive in order to secure the prosperity of his empire. And the change in Roman policy is so great that we find in under Augustus a kind of flowering of devotion to the imperial family. Augustus is hailed in an inscription from 29 BCE. The different provinces in Asia Minor seem to compete with one another to give the greatest honors to Caesar. And the province of Asia in 29 BCE votes to begin the new year on Augustus's birthday. And there's a long inscription that's been published in many different places. It reads in part as follows. This is a decree of the province of Asia. Whereas the providence that divinely ordered our lives created with zeal and generosity the most perfect good for our lives by producing Augustus and filling him with virtue for the benefaction of all humankind, sending us and those after a savior who put an end to war and established all things securely. And whereas Caesar, when he appeared, exceeded the hopes of all who had waited for good news, this is the word we get gospel from, not only by surpassing the benefactors born before him, but not even leaving those to come any hope of surpassing him. And whereas the birthday of the God marked for the world the beginning of good tidings, gospel, so on and so on, we will begin our new year. The beginning of the year on this day is further justified by appealing to the myth of creation. It goes on to say, we could justly hold the birth of the most divine Caesar to be equivalent to the beginning of all things, for he has restored all that had become imperfect and had fallen into misfortune. The whole world would have blithely embraced its own destruction had Caesar not been born for the common benefit of all. So his birth is, the inscription says, akin to the breath of life for all human beings. This is flowery language indeed, but there's a long tradition in the East of seeing the king as a quasi-divine figure. Through the king, the gods bring blessing, security, power, affluence, justice to society. And given the state of things under the Republic, Caesar is a breath of fresh air. So Asia, this large territory in the western part, but also even more inland, becomes a center of the cult of the Caesars, the imperial cult. You probably heard about this. It's actually somewhat of a, I would almost say, a fad in New Testament studies now to think about the ways in which the New Testament documents address, perhaps tangentially, the claims that the Caesars made about themselves and their role in securing universal prosperity. Simply stated, the Romans believed that their success was due to the goodwill of the gods, the Pax Deorum, the peace with the gods that they enjoyed, was guaranteed by their piety, by their religious observance, by their honoring of the gods. Several centuries earlier, the Greek historian Polybius comments about the Romans. This is now as they're just beginning to step on the stage as a world power. He writes, the greatest advantage of the Roman state appears to me to lie in their view of the gods. That which is a reproach for other people is precisely that which builds the foundation of the Roman state, that is, a virtually superstitious piety. Superstition's a bad word, an over-the-top worship of the gods. But Polybius said that kind of almost superstitious piety seems to be the key to Roman success. He says their religious practices play such a role in private life as in public life. It is so much the essence of both that one can hardly imagine it. Some decades later, Cicero writes, now from the inside as a Roman, talking about the superiority of Rome to other peoples, Cicero attributes this in large part to their faithfulness in honoring the gods. He writes, if we want to compare our situation with that of foreign peoples, then the following appears. In other areas, we Romans are equal to or even inferior to them. But when it comes to religion, that is, honoring the gods, we are far superior. The emperor, Augustus, takes this traditional piety toward the gods found in the home and in the public sphere, and he brings them together as he brings his own family cult out into public. So in a place like Rome that is very suspicious of kings and tyrants, in fact, Augustus brags at his death, he puts up a big monument of his deeds on his mausoleum in Rome, but significantly we found three copies of this in Asia Minor, including an almost perfect copy in modern Ankara, well up north in the hinterland of modern-day Turkey. Augustus brags about the fact that he refused the honor of dictator for life. He's simply the first citizen. And so Augustus would never claim divine honors for himself, at least in Rome or in a Roman colony. But after Julius Caesar is assassinated, the story goes out that Caesar was seen being taken up into heaven, kind of like Heracles or Aeneas. He's deified, being brought up to join the gods. And in fact, a particular Latin word, divus, is used now to speak about this kind of deification, where Deus is saved for Zeus or Jupiter and Minerva and gods like that. So Augustus is not himself a god, but he is the son of the deified Julius. He's got an open channel to the gods because his adopted father is among them. And Augustus takes his family hearth now out into the open square. So we'll have temples even during the time of Augustus, not to Augustus himself, but to the guardian spirit of Augustus, to the providence that watches over him. And these sorts of fine distinctions are pretty much lost in the East. To have a temple of Rome in Augustus is to have a temple that treats Augustus as standing among the gods as well. And after Augustus' death, of course, he too is deified, and subsequent Roman emperors continue then to be the son of gods, the son of the deified Julius and Augustus, some of them themselves joining them, others being denied those honors. In Asia Minor, we have cities competing for the honor of having a temple to the Augustan family. And so I mentioned these deeds of Augustus that are engraved in stone in Ankara. They're engraved on the walls of a temple to Rome and to Augustus. So just as we would honor all of the gods in order to keep our prosperity and peace, so now we honor the imperial family to keep peace with all of the gods. All of this is background to 1 Peter, in the sense that we can tell by reading between the lines in this letter that those addressed once belonged to these cultures. The author speaks of them as resident aliens, as foreigners, but it's clear that this is what they have become because God has chosen them. They've been given a new family, but they once belonged to this whole system of belief and of life. And this is a belief system, but one that was manifest in practice, in public practices. Civic life is very much embedded in religion. Religion is embedded in civic life. As Polybius said, for outsiders, it's amazing the extent to which these things are intertwined. It's one thing, perhaps, to be a foreigner by birth looking in on this. It's another thing to have belonged and now to find oneself on the outside. Let me say something briefly about the author and the audience, and then we'll dive into the letter a little bit in the time that's remaining for us. The letter is written from one who calls himself simply Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. At the end of the letter, he speaks about himself as a fellow elder and one who is a witness of Christ's sufferings. Chapter 5, verse 13, the author says that he is writing from Babylon. Gives greetings from your sister church in Babylon. He mentions two characters, Silvanus and Mark, that would be familiar to us from the narratives of Acts and also from Paul's letters. This is, as I said, a circular letter. The author, Peter, says that he's written briefly a word of consolation or encouragement and also a word of witness to the grace of God. And the encouragement is, this is the true grace of God. Stand fast in it. As I've suggested, the audience, from all that we can infer, is probably predominantly urban. Like most early Christians, probably the members of these communities did not belong to the elite strata of Roman society. There's been quite a lot of discussion of late about the scale of wealth and poverty in the Roman Empire. It's very clear that there's nothing like a middle class. Basically, there's an elite. There's several elite strata, but the upper 1%, literally, and then pretty much the 99% fall much lower on the spectrum. There's a huge disparity of wealth. And it doesn't appear from either the Pauline letters, and we even have less information about these communities, that we had any at this really upper elite level. However, the lower levels weren't simply undifferentiated. There were various strata, from those who lived really below the level of subsistence to people, probably the majority, that lived right around the subsistence level, that were vulnerable to famine, that could probably get along, but just so. And then probably we should imagine a couple strata above that, people that had a modest surplus, people that perhaps had businesses or owned homes and ran households big enough to host the churches. So even though the Christians are probably in that lower 99%, there's still enough difference that we can see, for example, in 1 Corinthians, that the disparities in wealth and status can cause real trouble within the Christian community. But these are folks, the letter addresses slaves and uses the word for household slaves, so we're probably, again, envisioning city dwellers rather than large agricultural estates using slave labor. It's not actually clear that Asia Minor relied much on slaves for agriculture. We have heads of households envisioned, a household that would include not only wife and children, but perhaps older generations of the family and dependents, such as slaves and freed people. Peter addresses women who are married to husbands who do not believe, who do not belong to the community. And we'll see later on that that creates particular stresses given the cultural assumptions of the day, the place of women in the household and the role of the head of the household. For the most part, these addressees seem to be Gentiles. And this is striking because the author quotes Scripture abundantly throughout the letter. And in fact, as we'll see, addresses them with titles given to Israel in the Scriptures of the Old Testament. But he refers to their feudal way of life that they inherited from their ancestors. In another place, he says, you've spent enough time living like the nations do. So it appears that the addressees, rhetorically at least, are those who have come from a Gentile background and now are learning to understand themselves as belonging to the story of Israel. Most notably, 1 Peter tells us that these communities have been named Christians, apparently by outsiders. Only in 1 Peter and Acts do we actually find the communities being called Christians, and in Acts also, in the city of Antioch in Syria, it's outsiders who give them this name. Probably it's not meant as a compliment. Some translate it, try to find some way to translate it, Christ lackeys or something like that. It makes clear that for outsiders, the identification with Christ is paramount in this community's own self-understanding. They're different, and their difference is, they say, probably the internal language is, I belong to Christ. It's something pronounced over us in baptism, according to Paul. We're baptized into Christ. But in 1 Peter, we find a situation where this stigma put on this group, Christians, has now become an occasion perhaps for not just slander and social pressure verbally, but has perhaps become an actionable offense. That is, it's become something for which someone can be guilty. Simply because of the name Christian, they might be treated as an evildoer. And so 1 Peter gives us, in the New Testament, the clearest picture of a problem that will increasingly beset the early church, and that is the hostility of outsiders and the potential of having to suffer simply for the name Christian rather than for any wrongdoing that anyone can prove. There's a big debate about the date of this letter. It somewhat involves whether you think that Peter, the apostle, the disciple of Jesus, wrote it, or whether it was written in his name by later followers who continued his teaching. I don't want to go into that so much, except to say that we really don't know a lot about the first Christian century. According to Paul's first letter, 1 Thessalonians, persecution, slander, hostility by outsiders is a fact of life from the very earliest time. He speaks about the brothers and sisters in Judea experiencing the same kind of hostility that these Macedonian believers are now experiencing from their fellow countrymen. The book of Acts shows us in remarkable detail how in these various local cultures in Asia Minor and in Greece, the Christians run into different forms of hostility as their message is seen as socially subversive and politically subversive. But many have seen a particular place for 1 Peter later on in the first century. There is a kind of watershed event that you will know well, and that is in the 60s, early 60s, after the Great Fire in Rome. The Emperor Nero pins the deed on the Christians. So later historian Tacitus says he picked a group universally hated for their awful foreign beliefs and their antisocial behavior. And Tacitus is sorry that this was so clearly a made-up charge, but he still thinks it's all right that the Christians were gotten rid of because they're a problem, they're a plague on society. But what's interesting is that Nero at this point, or his agents, could sufficiently distinguish Christians from among the many Jews who lived in Rome. And it seems that perhaps after this precedent, the name Christian itself becomes, as I say, an actionable offense in the eyes of the government. From what we can tell, Christians are dealt with on an ad hoc basis by the Roman authorities well into the 3rd century, when finally with Decius there is a ban of Christianity. But the fact that they're dealing with it on an ad hoc basis doesn't make it any less real. In fact, the kind of situation that we see in 1 Peter is one in which local pressure, slander, suspicion, hostility can come to the attention of government officials with deadly results. And there's an exchange of letters from early in the 2nd century. I printed it here because it's fairly long, but I'd like to look at it with you. This is often cited as relevant, at least to the situation envisioned in 1 Peter. It's an exchange of letters between Pliny the Younger and the Emperor Trajan. Pliny was sent to Bithynia, northern Asia Minor, to sort of set in order the various cities there. He's the governor. And he published his correspondence with Trajan. He constantly is writing back to Rome for advice and guidance. It's clear from some of Trajan's responses that sometimes he asks too many questions and the emperor gets a little frustrated with him, but Pliny is a good government official who wants to do the right thing. And this letter that I printed for you is about people called Christians who have been brought to his attention. So if you'll let me read it with you. "It is my custom, sire, to refer to you in all cases where I am in doubt, for who can better clear up difficulties and inform me? I have never been present at any legal examination of the Christians, and I do not know, therefore, what are the usual penalties passed upon them, or the limits of those penalties, or how searching an inquiry should be made." Note that Pliny is very polite here. He's asking for guidance. It's going to come out later that he actually does have a sense of what he ought to do because he's already been acting. But notice, too, that he understands that this is not the first time that Christians have appeared before Roman officials. He wonders there must be some precedent. He's just not aware of what the custom is. "I have hesitated a great deal in considering whether any distinction should be drawn according to the ages of the accused, whether the weak should be punished as severely as the more robust, or whether the man who was once a Christian gained anything by recanting. Again, whether the name of being a Christian, the name itself, even though otherwise innocent of crime, should be punished, or only the crimes that gather around it. Notice again here the particular issue that Pliny is asking about. Is it sufficient simply for someone to say, I am a Christian? Is that already a crime worthy of punishment? He also, though, gathers that there are crimes associated with being a Christian. We hear from the early church fathers some of these slanders, these Christians who meet in secret. They call themselves brother and sister. They greet one another with a holy kiss. They eat strange foods. They're probably engaged in incest and sexual immorality. They're probably a subversive sect, and that's why they meet in secret. They may well eat human flesh in their meal. Don't they have someone whose body and blood that they eat? All of these kinds of slanders Pliny has heard about, but he wants to be just, and he wants to think carefully about the right way to handle this from the perspective of the state. So in the meantime, it's going to take a while to get this letter back. This is the plan which I have adopted in the case of those Christians who have been brought before me. Notice he hasn't gone and sought them out, but Christians have been brought before him. I ask them whether they are Christians. If they say yes, then I repeat the question the second time, and also a third, warning them of the penalties involved. And if they persist, I order them away to prison. For I do not doubt that, be their admitted crime what it may, their pertinacity and inflexible obstinacy surely ought to be punished. There were others who showed similar mad folly, whom I reserved to be sent to Rome, since they were Roman citizens. Later, as is commonly the case, the mere fact of my entertaining the question led to a multiplying of accusations, and a variety of cases were brought before me. An anonymous pamphlet was issued containing a number of names of alleged Christians. So notice this. We know the governor's in town. He's trying Christians. Now we can do something about these annoying people who are a plague on our society. These are neighbors bringing one another up to the Roman governor. Those who denied that they were or had been Christians and called upon the gods with the usual formula, reciting the words after me, and those who offered incense and wine before your image, which I had ordered to be brought forward for this purpose, along with the regular statues of the gods, all such I considered acquitted, especially as they cursed the name of Christ, which it is said bona fide Christians cannot be induced to do. Still others there were whose names were supplied by an informer. These first said that they were Christians, then denied it, insisting that they had been but were so no longer. Some of them having recanted many years ago, and more than one full 20 years back. These all worshipped your image and the god's statues and cursed the name of Christ. So this perhaps is not the first time that there has been significant pressure on the Christian communities in his area. Some 20 years ago had stopped being Christians, yet neighbors remember. All the same, they declared their guilt or error was simply this. On a fixed day, they used to meet before dawn and recite a hymn among themselves to Christ as though he were a god. So far from binding themselves by oath to commit any crime, they swore to keep from theft, robbery, adultery, breach of faith, and swore not to deny any trust money deposited with them when called upon to deliver it. This ceremony over, they used to depart and meet again to take food, but it was of no special character and entirely harmless. They had also ceased from this practice after the edict I issued, by which, in according with your orders, I forbade all secret societies. So in the Romans' eyes, the Christians make sense as one of these little voluntary secret groups that pops up from time to time that follows some kind of a mad foreign superstition and that generally ought to be suppressed for the health of the state. I thought it then, things are spiraling now, more needful to get at the facts behind their statements. Therefore, I placed two women called deaconesses under torture, but I found only a debased superstition carried to great lengths, so I postponed my examination and immediately consulted you. These deaconesses clearly were not Roman citizens. They may well have been slaves. Slaves' evidence was not admitted in court unless it was gathered under torture. This seems a matter worthy of your prompt consideration, especially as so many people are endangered. Many of all ages and both sexes are put in peril of their lives by their accusers, And the process will go on, for the contagion of this superstition, that is Christianity, has spread not merely through the free towns, but into the villages and farms. Still, I think it can be halted and set right. Beyond any doubt, the temples, which were nigh deserted, are beginning again to be thronged with worshipers. The sacred rites, which long have lapsed, are now being renewed, and the food for the sacrificial victims is again finding a sale, though up to recently it had almost no market. So one can safely infer how vast numbers could be reclaimed if only there were a chance given for repentance. This is dated around 110 CE, and Pliny is showing us a situation in which people from various classes of both sexes, living in cities but also in rural areas, are caught up in this superstition. And he's hoping to find a policy by which they can be forced to recant and be reintegrated back into society. He alludes to the effect of, apparently, of Christian faith on traditional worship. People have stopped coming in great numbers to the temples. The civic ceremonies in honor of the gods have fallen on hard times. Even the butchers are having a hard time selling the meat of the sacrificial animals. This situation, of course, has its parallels in the book of Acts. You might think about the threat to the business of the silversmiths in Ephesus presented by Paul. Pliny, though, shows us that the Roman government, when faced with these Christians, was willing to, in fact, committed to stamping them out. Trajan's reply is, "You have adopted the right course, my dear Pliny, in examining the cases of those cited before you as Christians. No hard and fast rule can be laid down covering such a wide question. But the Christians are not to be hunted out. If brought before you and the offense is proved, they are to be punished, apparently with death. But with this reservation, if anyone denies he is a Christian and makes clear he is not by offering prayer to our gods, then he is to be pardoned on his recantation, no matter how suspicious his past. As for anonymous pamphlets, they are to be discarded absolutely, whatever crime they may charge, for they are not only a precedent of a very bad type, but they do not accord with the spirit of our age." Trajan is remembered as a good emperor, and you see the Romans trying to make sense of this early Christian movement and unable to see it as anything other than a threat, and yet one which doesn't need their direct attention. One, in fact, in which the greatest threat to Christians is that their neighbors might bring them to the attention of the authorities. How amazing, then, that 1 Peter intends to give these communities the ability to continue doing what is right, engaging in patient and respectful but courageous witness among these very neighbors who represent the greatest threat to their existence. What I hope to unfold for you in the coming sessions together is the ways in which Peter gives a new story, a new identity, a new sense of calling to these once Gentiles and now members of God's own household. He gives them a new identity, a new way of looking at their past and thus at their present and their future. We see the beginning of this in his address to them. He calls them resident aliens of the diaspora. Diaspora is a word chosen by the Jewish community scattered in the wake of the Babylonian exile. And diaspora continues to be the identity of Jews who live apart from the land and perhaps very happily live apart from the land, but still see the center of their worship and their hope in the God of Israel, whose temple is in Jerusalem, and whose Torah is now read in their synagogues. These Gentiles are identified as members of that wider dispersion. They're also identified as resident aliens. This is a term that would refer to someone who had the political status of being an outsider to the city. So in Greek and in Roman religion, if you weren't a citizen of Athens, you couldn't participate in Athenian religion. If you were a citizen of Corinth, you would participate in Corinthian religion. But if you were resident in Athens, you would be one of these resident aliens. You'd have a legal status, an ability to reside there, but it wasn't your home. Now, it may be that some of the actual people being addressed in this wide area were resident aliens, people who had moved or been displaced for one reason or another. But clearly, the author is giving this as a metaphor for the whole community. They're to see themselves now not as home, not as at home where they live, but as those who have a home elsewhere. And where that home is with the God of Israel. They belong to this dispersion because they belong to the household, to the people of God. This notion of the people of God as foreigners is a tradition that looks back to the patriarchs, to Abraham, who sojourns in the promised land as a foreigner and who has to buy a plot of land to bury his wife, Sarah, because he owns none of it. It's a metaphor that is taken up in other strands of early Christianity, most notably in the book of Hebrews, where the patriarchs and all the faithful of all the ages look ahead to the city that God is building for them. Here we have no lasting city. Rather than see Rome as the source of all good, the emperor as the conduit of peace with the gods, the author very subtly but very clearly labels Rome a new Babylon, this prototypical enemy of the people of God, this empire that destroyed the temple and scattered the people, an instrument in God's hand to bring judgment but ultimately to bring blessing in God's providence to Israel. Rome is not the eternal empire. Rome is just another manifestation of ancient Babylon. The negative identity, you are foreigners, Rome is Babylon, not home, is actually, though, the flip side of the positive case that our author makes, because Peter gives a new story, a new identity. You belong to God. That is why you're foreigners. You, in fact, are chosen and destined by God, who is God our Father. You have been sanctified, made holy, set apart for God by His Spirit. And your calling is to be obedient to Jesus Christ and to be sprinkled with His blood. How this all plays out will be the focus of our next hour together. I've got 8 minutes on this clock at least, though. I'd like to just open up a chance for question or clarification. And great, we've got mics so everybody can hear.
The team.
Thank you.
Okay. Ross, with this idea of all of the Caesars being deified and ascending, what would be your response to Bart Ehrman, whose latest popular work says that Jesus was deified in exactly the same way?
Yeah, that's Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman has an amazing knack for writing books that say things that people have said for a couple hundred years, but making them sound fresh. This idea that well, and then he's really good at selling the books to people who don't know that these ideas have been around for a couple hundred years. Yeah, that there's a parallel between, you know, the birth narratives of Jesus and the story of Alexander the Great being, you know, the child of Apollo who came as a snake to his, you know. Yeah, there are certainly cultural contacts with the idea of a human being divinized. And there may have been some early Christians who thought in those terms. I think the counter-argument, though, is, and here I would point to the work of Larry Hurtado and Richard Baucom, who've both written quite a bit about early veneration of Jesus as God, that this is very early, and it happens in the Jewish among the Jewish followers of Jesus. This isn't a Roman idea, and it's not a late idea, kind of let's make up some narratives so Jesus looks as good as Augustus. The conviction that Jesus is worthy of the worship that should be given only to the God of Israel seems to take hold very early. And you know, I would say in response to the resurrection, to the conviction that Jesus is not only raised but exalted to God's right hand. So yeah, there are parallels, just as though there are parallels to a rising and dying God, but I don't think they're sufficient to explain why this idea takes hold. If Jesus is to be worshipped along with God, Then the early Christians think about how to talk about this in many different ways. They borrow language of wisdom. Jesus is the word or the wisdom of God. Jesus is the reflection or the emanation of God's glory. Peter will tell us that in God's plan, because God's plan centers on what Jesus has done for us in the cross and resurrection, this was a plan that would have been enacted before the foundation of the world. I mean, you can see, I suppose, if you look, you can see ways in which early Christian thought kind of goes from the resurrection and exaltation, both forward, Jesus is heir of all things, he is the one in whom all things will come together, but they also go backward, before the foundation of the world. But that's different from saying that they had to come up with a good story, and so they looked around and they said, oh yeah, Jesus is just better than the Caesars.
Could you name those two authors again?
Richard Bauckham, and Larry Hurtado. Hey, Russ.
Yeah, I want to thank you for your comments already. I couldn't help but think in this first section about the sprinkling of blood.
Yeah.
And then because it's Asia Minor and Revelation, where Christ is going to conquer and Christians conquer through his blood.
Yeah.
Is this then kind of in a similar kind of way of speaking to a similar culture, similar group, that, you know, you are resident aliens, you are marginalized, and you're going to have strength through your suffering? I mean, is that, I see that in Revelation. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting to see you go through First Peter, but does that idea get carried forth?
Yeah, that's a really helpful thought question. The letters to the seven churches, of course, are addressed to this area in Asia. So there's some overlap with First Peter in terms of the communities envisioned. The notion of sprinkling with Jesus' blood, First Peter is one of these New Testament letters that has resonances with the gospel tradition, with Paul, with Hebrews, with Revelation. In some ways, this is a letter that brings together all kinds of early Christian traditions into a really powerful synthesis. He's going to talk later in chapter 1 about Christ as the Passover lamb. So I think in the sprinkling there may be, you know, looking forward, kind of a reference to that, but also more generally to the sacrificial cult, in which blood is sprinkled to inaugurate the covenant, to inaugurate the people as the people of God. Hebrews develops this much more elaborately, but in being sprinkled with the blood of the covenant, the people of Israel are taken as God's own. And you have then sprinkling of altar and sprinkling of, yeah.
I was just wondering where, if they are people who are also, I mean, they're probably experiencing the sprinkling of their own blood. And is this a way to encourage them that, you know, you are following your Lord in this way? Not for salvation, nothing like that, but for people who, hey, we serve a God who was destroyed, who was killed, but won.
Yeah.
You know, this is to give you some encouragement, you who are marginalized, you who are shedding your own blood. I mean, I see that in Revelation.
Yep.
I'm just not sure.
Yeah, okay, sorry, now I understand. Yeah, is there a resonance with the kind of blood of the martyrs here? I would have to say that I don't see that in 1 Peter itself. I mean, we're also reading 1 Peter as part of the canon, and we can think about how it's read 100 years later. I think there's important resonances with the kind of view. But in 1 Peter, he speaks about a fiery trial that you're experiencing. But he continues to, and maybe because it's such a wide area, he continues to sort of imagine suffering as maybe, possibly, if it should be God's will. It's not necessarily reality for them yet. We don't get anything as explicit as the references in Revelation to actual martyrs, Antipas, my faithful witness. Yeah, are we on the verge of bloodshed? Is there bloodshed? And Peter may not know, writing to such a vast community.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting there in the last sentence where it says, sprinkling for the obedience to Jesus Christ, then the sprinkling of his blood. It seems like that should be reversed. It should be the sprinkling of blood first and then the obedience. Can you speak to that?
Interesting. Well, I think that's one thing we'll want to watch for, is what is the relationship in 1 Peter between what God has done for us and what we're called to do? And that'll come out, I think, strongly in the next session as we look at this opening doxology. Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's been a puzzle for me too. Why sprinkling last? And my answer for now is that that there is a sense in which the first thing and the last thing in a sentence get priority. And I think he may have said it that way for obedience and sprinkling by his blood to give weight to that. But I think as we unpack the letter, it's going to be clear that there's a kind of indicative that comes before the imperative. That is, in as far as anyone can outline this letter, up to about chapter 2, verse 10, the focus is on what God has done in giving new birth and creating this new community. It's at 2:11 that the call to live out your calling really takes over the letter. And I think that's really important. It is what God does first that enables the calling, the obedience of the community. Good. Maybe we have time for one more, and then yeah. Back there. Yeah.
Can you describe the context in which a member of the community or all community would have heard, or did they have a chance to read this letter, and was it in
great.
Worship or what?
Great. No, great question. These again are kind of vast topics of debate. What do we know about literacy in the first century? It appears that throughout the Greco-Roman world, a very small number of people actually have the complete technology of reading and writing, and yet people interact with texts all the time. Most likely, most people will experience First Peter by hearing it read. And if we have, you know, we sort of drawing bits and pieces from Paul's letters in particular, it sounds like this would have been read at a gathering of the community. So if you go into the second century with Justin Martyr, he says, when we meet together, we read from the scriptures and from the memoirs of the apostles as long as we have time for. Paul imagines that the communities are going to read his letters, and 1 Corinthians indicates that they read them and also argued about it and discussed it and decided to write Paul a follow-up letter. So I imagine that Silvanus mentioned at the end may well be the bearer of the letter. Silvanus may be on a long journey where he goes from place to place, reads the letter out to the community. They may make a copy so they can keep it. Again, evidence that comes from a century or more later when the Romans periodically decide to round up the texts of these Christians, we find that people are keeping the texts in their homes because someone is designated as the reader of John's gospel or the reader of Paul's letter to the Romans. People had to practice and they perhaps became, in a sense, interpreters for the community of that particular letter. So yeah, this is, we read it in translation, but you can get an awful lot of the feeling of 1 Peter in translation. It's a beautifully constructed sermon letter. It's constructed for the ear. There's all kinds of rhythm and alliteration and wordplay. 1 Peter, actually, of the New Testament, is right up there with Acts and Hebrews as the most sophisticated Greek. So it is a letter that's meant to move an audience. It's meant to communicate in a powerful way to affect their life and practice. Well, we'll continue the conversation.